business on genus and species has got to be covered because it's key to the worldview of the whole book, and it's key to it's a necessary basis for some of the things that will come up in the metaphysics later on. So what I'm going to do is to take, in terms of my notes, numbers 10, 11, and 14. Genus is 10 and 11 and 14 is species. The rest of the book you can read those, and you can raise any questions with me practically about those. That's what you want. In terms of the genus and species, the Flanagan article that I gave you will be helpful on this, because what Flanagan does is to take all of this and put it into the context of finality as a metaphysical category, which comes up later on in the book, but particularly vertical finality, which is spoken of more in some of Lonergan's other writings than it is in the insight itself. So it will help to locate this discussion in terms of the broader framework. When things are posited as instances of the already out there now, philosophically, okay, and when every event is thought to be completely determined by classical laws, so that there isn't any probability, there's no non-systematic in the universe, then there is no room for a succession of ever higher systems. Now, we're talking now in terms of an evolutionary theory, like a measured probability. All things are conceived as of a single kind, and that's one of the characteristics of mechanist determinism, that everything's got to be reduced to the lowest common denominator. But if this notion of thing is a valid notion, as an intelligible, concrete unity differentiated by experiential and then especially explanatory conjugate, that notion allows for the possibility of different kinds of things and distinct sets of explanatory conjugates. So that's what a genus, genera, or the notion of genus, is an explanatory notion now, to speak about different kinds of things and different kinds of sets of explanatory conjugates. So there arises the notion of genus as an explanatory category. Now I quoted here, and I think if we can work with his symbols, it can be extremely helpful. I know some minds work better with this kind of symbolic notation than others, so we'll have to give examples, and I give examples after this, quoting with examples. But consider a genus of things T sub I. So let's say a genus subatomic elements with explanatory conjugates C sub I. And a second genus of things T sub J, chemical elements or chemical compounds, with explanatory conjugates C sub I and C sub J. So subatomic explanatory conjugates and chemical. Such that all conjugates of the type C sub I are defined by relations, by their relations to one another. And similarly, all conjugates of the type C sub J are defined by their relations to one another. Then, since C sub I and C sub J, subatomic and chemical compounds, differ, there will be two different systems of terms and relations. As the basic terms and relations differ, all logically derived terms and relations will differ, so that by logical operations alone, there's no transition from one system to the other. So what he's talking about here is that as you move from a lower to a higher, or from a, if you don't like the hierarchical language, then from a more basic to a more complex, you're not talking about something that can then be reduced back. We're talking about a definite progression where there is not any kind of logical connection from one to another. In terms of our knowing of them, there's not a logical connection so that you can reduce the later to the earlier. And in reality, there's no kind of determinant connection so that the later can be reduced back to the former. The examples will help here. Thus, the laws of physics hold for subatomic elements, C sub I, T sub I. The laws of physics and chemistry hold for chemical elements and compounds, so C sub I and C sub J, physics and chemistry. And to be a chemist, you've also got to know physics. The laws of physics, chemistry, and biology hold for plants. We talk here about C sub I, C sub J, and C sub K. The laws of physics, chemistry, and biology hold for plants? The laws of physics, chemistry, biology, and sensitive psychology hold for animals. The laws of physics, chemistry, biology, sensitive psychology, and rational psychology hold for human beings. As one moves from one genus to the next, there's added a new set of laws, which defines its own basic terms by its own empirically established correlations. When one turns from physics and chemistry to astronomy, one employs the same basic terms and correlations. And so astronomy is a matter of physics and chemistry applied to a certain set of data. But when one turns from physics and chemistry to biology, one is confronted with an entirely new set of basic concepts and laws. And then I want to refer you to the book I should have quoted for the next paragraph, page 281, the paragraph considered. Consider then a genus of things T sub I with explanatory conjugates C sub I and a consequent list of possible schemes of occurrence S sub I. So let's say that we're talking about subatomic elements. Suppose there occurs an aggregate of events E sub I J that is merely coincidental when considered in the light of the laws of the things T sub I and of all their possible schemes of occurrence S sub I. Then, if the aggregate of events E sub ij occurs regularly, it is necessary to advance to the higher viewpoint of some genus of things T sub j, chemical elements and compounds, with conjugates C sub I and C sub j, and with schemes of recurrence S sub j. The lower viewpoint is insufficient, for it has to regard as merely coincidental what in fact is regular. The higher viewpoint is justified for the conjugates C sub J and the schemes S sub J constitute a higher system that makes regular what otherwise would be merely coincidental. So from the standpoint of physics and chemistry, life is merely coincidental. From the standpoint of physics, chemistry, and biology, the behavior of a cat is merely coincidental. From the standpoint of physics, chemistry, biology, sensitive psychology, the behavior of a human being, inquiring, understanding, reflecting, judging, deliberating, deciding, loving, is merely coincidental. It can't be explained from the standpoint of the laws of those other sciences. And so that's what gives rise to the notion of genus as an explanatory category. Number 11, then. How does the possibility of new genera arise? This quotation is from page 281. I didn't put the page in there. If the laws of subatomic elements have to regard the regular behavior of atoms as mere patterns of happy coincidences, then there is an autonomous science of chemistry. If the laws of chemistry have to regard the metabolism and division of cells as mere patterns of happy coincidences, then there is an autonomous science of biology. If the laws of biology have to regard the behavior of animals as mere patterns of happy coincidences, in other words, they can't really understand them as being distinct from plants from the standpoint of the lower, then there is an autonomous science of sensitive psychology. If the laws of sensitive psychology have to regard the operations of mathematicians and scientists, or again, of people deliberating about the fate of their nation or whatever, as mere patterns of happy coincidences, then there is an autonomous science of rational psychology, or whatever you want to call it, cognitional theory, human psychology. Nor does the introduction of the higher autonomous science interfere with the autonomy of the lower. The laws of physics still hold in human beings. For the higher enters into the field of the lower only insofar as it makes systematic on the lower level what otherwise would be merely coincidental. The succession of sciences corresponding to the succession of higher genera does not admit any purely logical transition. But logical operations, and again, this is getting right at the heart of his cognitional theory as well here, logical operations, deduction, and so on, are merely part of the full knowing process. They're confined to concepts, definitions, hypotheses, theories, affirmations, and negations. This field is only part of a larger domain that includes as well sensitive presentations and imaginative representations, inquiry and insight, reflection and critical understanding, And for those non-logical operations, intelligent and reasonable but non-logical operations, we move on. And in this larger domain, the successive departments of science are related. For the laws of the lower yield images in which insight grasps clues to laws of the higher order. We're dealing here with successive higher viewpoints. If the real is the verified, then the transition images that are yielded by the laws of the lower are merely heuristic. They're not pictures of reality. Again, since there is no verifiable image of the subatomic, there can be no verifiable image of objects composed of subatomic elements. The verifiably imagined is restricted to the sensibly given. So when you're in an explanatory framework, when you're in an explanatory mindset, you have to be content with reasonable affirmations of intelligently conceived terms and relations. You can't expect the sciences to tell us what scientific reality looks like. Scientific reality doesn't look like anything, but it is a matter of intelligently conceived terms and relations, reasonably affirmed because verified. The transition images represent, perhaps only symbolically, the coincidental manifold that becomes systematic once you've seen proven linear genes. So this is the whole thing that was in the introduction about there has to be some kind of severing of the umbilical cord that ties our conceptions to the imagination. Right? And that the images are springboards. But that when we get into explanation, you can't demand of Einstein, okay, paint me a picture. Because there isn't a picture that corresponds. There isn't a picture that tells you what that looks like. And if you verify that and continue to verify it, then it's probably true. That's the main point. Is there anything we need to? I think we've seen enough of this, how what is non-systematic, when it becomes regular, you're moving to a new level. When what is coincidental becomes regular, then you're moving from subatomic to atoms to life to consciousness to human. Are you okay? Or not? Is there a mystery? Shall it be?
Then, sort of the contemporary way of thinking of reality as language is sort of, in a way, it's true here that the categories we have to explain reality exist in the way we define them, the way we intelligently construct them. Can you say it in that way?
I don't think that that's complete.
No,
I don't think that's a complete. Statement of the point that he's making, because he's saying that those categories come out of insight into these heuristic images.
No, I would agree, and I there are postmodernists who go further, and that's
yeah.
But no, that's makes sense.
There, I mean, it's ultimately. I had this discussion with one of you yesterday. We're ultimately coming back to that it all hinges on the issue of, is there such a thing as insight into phantasm that itself is pre-linguistic and gives rise to inner and outer words? Is there or is there not? So you've got Aristotle had insight into image. Augustine had insight giving rise to concept, to inner word. And Thomas put those two together and came up with image, insight, concept, and added judgment. And we're back to that in the contemporary debates. In the postmodern debates, we're back to it with Wittgenstein, we're back to it with the later Heidegger and the primacy of language in the later Heidegger. Gadamer, I think, interestingly enough, at least if Lawrence's interpretation of Gadamer is correct, Gadamer is with Lonergan on the verbum in Thomas. And Gadamer actually, in Truth and Method, with our Heidegger, refers to the same medieval insight into verbum and into understanding giving rise to it. that Donovan exploits into this book. You know, Senator Gadamer and Donovan are on the same page on this issue. But there, it is, this is the issue, I think. Is there insight into phantasm that is preconceptual? And does that insight give rise to the world? And for Donovan, that's the only way in which you can explain the development of the human will. You can't explain it otherwise. If you start with the linguistic as determining everything, then that's conceptualism. That's the contemporary variant of Scholes conceptualism. If language is all determined. So, I mean, I've said for years that Wittgenstein, whether he was influenced by Scholes or not, is a contemporary Scholes. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't something valid there. Lauterman takes it over in Method and Theology and talks about ordinary meaningfulness, and that all of Wittgenstein's insights can be brought to bear, and Heidegger too, on ordinary meaningfulness. But that's the question of what gives rise to original meaning, to new meaning. It's original insight. It may depend upon a linguistic framework, but sometimes has to break through that linguistic framework to express it. It's the whole issue. Okay, then the species thing in number 14 is simply an elaboration of this, that not only do you have the development into new genera because of moving from subatomic to atoms to cells to animals to human beings, but that within those genera you can have different series of conjugates that all are animals. For instance, I mean, let's take something that we're familiar with, that within the genera of animals, you've got dogs and cats and horses and so on. And that the interesting thing is, the interesting suggestion in all of that that Lonergan is making here is that the differentiation of the species within the genera has got to be on the level of what makes the generic difference there. So that the difference between different kinds of animals is ultimately psychological. Even though there's an organic difference, the explanation is going to be psychological, or even different kinds of dogs. I mean, I think we can admit that the difference between a pit bull and a schnauzer is a psychological difference. it's not just the physical difference. There is something psychological to it. On page 6 in my notes, an explanatory account of animal species will differentiate animals not by their organic, I mean, partly, sure, by their organic, but ultimately by their psychic differences. The animal belongs to an explanatory genus beyond that of the plant, and so it's not to be explained simply on the basis of organism. That genus turns on sensibility. Its specific differences are differences of sensibility, and it's in differences of sensibility that there are to be found the basis for differences of organic structure. Since that structure possesses a degree of freedom that is limited but not controlled by underlying materials and other circumstances. Now, not all animal scientists will agree with that, but it's definitely showing you how non-reductionist this picture is. And then the final thing, the final statement here, and this will be carry on later into a further metaphysics of humanity. In human beings, we reach the inquiry and insight that are not so much a higher system as a perennial source of higher systems, because now you've got the creation of systems through artifacts, through art, but also through cultures, so that human beings are the perennial source of the Roman Empire, for instance, is Dorothy's question. Okay, perennial source of higher systems, and so human being is at once explanatory genus as a higher system beyond sensibility, and explanatory species as a source of higher systems, such as the transition from the intelligent. A rather almost overwhelming and powerful description of that thing we have later on. Once you reach the human being, you have, well, it's basically the same thing that you said here, but in terms of puts it more metaphysically later, that there is the creation of new systems in terms of cultures, and so that evolution, biological evolution, gives way to culture.
Can we move to the next chapter? The club said, please.
All right, chapter 9. New set of notes. And on these notes, numbers 1 to 11 constitute chapter 9, and numbers 12 to 23 constitute chapter 10. And in terms of the MP3s that are now available, the new MP3s that Ben has just finished, this will be chapters 9 and 10 are the whole of the MP3 for August the 8th. Both parts 1 and part 2. The MP3 for August 8 is this material for chapters 9 and 10. And it would be well worth your while to listen to what I've been talking about for the rest to say to understand the judgmental effect of this. So chapters 9 and 10 treat a third level of cognitional activity, judgment and its ground in reflective understanding. So up to this point, we've been concerned exclusively with the relationship between empirical presentations through sense and imagination, as he's presenting it here, empirical presentations and understanding, different types of insight into empirical presentations. Now, as Lonergan puts it often, lectures, insights are a dime a dozen, and the problem is figuring out which ones are right, and that's the issue of judgment. So, is it so? So you raise a question about what's going on in my experience, and you come to some kind of formulation of that, then you've got the further question, is it so? Is it true? Is this the case? And that's what we're dealing with now. Judgment and its ground in reflective understanding. This is direct understanding. So in between direct understanding and judgment, there will be another act called reflective understanding. And reflective understanding is the grasp of the sufficiency of the evidence for a prospective judgment. It's the grasp that the evidence is or is not sufficient for the judgment. If you grasp that it is, you must. If you're going to be reasonable, you must judge. If you grasp that it's not, then you've got to withhold. To be reasonable is to make one's judgments in accord with the evidence for it. That's what is meant by reasonableness. Reasonableness is judging in accord with the grasp of evidence. So the yes or no of judgment is a second inner word. The inner word that corresponds to direct understanding is the concept, the hypothesis, the definition, whatever it is that you're doing. What is it? What's going on? And then the inner word that flows from reflective understanding is yes or no. And it flows as an inner word. Don't even have to say yes or no, but there's something that happens in interiority when you assent. Okay? That's what is meant by inner word. It's that event of assent. So the yes or no of judgment is the second inner word, following upon a second act of understanding in which there is grasped the sufficiency of evidence for a prospective judgment. Okay, so he's got, first of all, some determinations of judgment that make it different from insight understanding. A first determination of judgment is reached when we distinguish two attitudes that one may take toward propositions. One may merely consider propositions, or one may agree or disagree with them. In the first case, the proposition is the content of an act of thinking, supposing, considering, and so on, but you're still on this level. In the second case, the proposition is the content of an act of judgment. So if I say to you that if I say to you it's warm in here, and if you're saying, you know, then you just consider it. well, maybe it's one thing, but it's not for you, or so on and so forth. But if you assent to that, then it becomes the content, the proposition becomes the content of the act of judging. It's clear when we talk about matters of belief, which is a form of assent, although it's not the form of assent that he's talking to here. But where Lonergan came to his notion of judgment was by reading John Henry Newman's Grammar of Assent. And in Newman's Grammar of Assent, Newman is mainly talking about the assent of belief. And when we say that we can take two attitudes towards the propositions that are offered us by the Church, we can merely consider them, or we can assent to them. If we merely consider them, then we're at this level. If we assent to them, we're at this level. Now we'll see belief as a distinct kind of assent from this, but that's where this all got started for Lonergan. His notion of judgment and the way in which he talks about it. Basically, his primary influence here, although judgment is in Thomas, his primary influence on the psychology of judgment is in Newman. A second determination of judgment is reached by distinguishing questions for intelligence from questions for reflection. Questions for intelligence, again, what is it? Why is it? And so on. Questions that cannot be answered yes or no. What is this? Why is this so? Why does this happen? How often does it happen? And so on. Questions for intelligence. And questions for reflection, is that the case? Is it so? Is it true? Questions that can be answered yes or no. Judging is answering yes or no to the question for reflection. The third determination is that compared to understanding, judgment involves a personal commitment. The question for reflection can be answered not only by yes or no, but also by I don't know, I don't know, maybe, probably. The judgment, we know, we have a sense, we are aware of a responsibility for judgment that is not there when we're simply considering things. You can consider things all day long and you don't have to have responsibility for your thoughts. But once you assent, somehow there's much more of you that's at stake in your assenting than there is in what you think about. You can think about anything at all. But what you assent to says something much more about who you are. And in that sense, there's responsibility and commitment involved in judgment, but it's not the case with understanding, thinking, considering, conceptualizing, hypothesizing, and so on. So those three determinations of it that make it distinct from it's not just considering propositions but assenting to them. It's not the response to a question for intelligence but to a question for reflection. And there's a personal, it's personal knowledge in a way that understanding and thinking and considering and conceptualizing is not. The person is more at stake. And the person, of course, becomes even more at stake when you get to the next level of consciousness, decision. Because in your decisions, you are deciding not only what you're going to do, but who you're going to be, what kind of person you're going to be. All right, so we're becoming more existential as we move to the level of judgment, and we're becoming even more existential when we move to the level of decision. Number five, judgment has its own relation to the whole structure of cognitional process. Let me just get rid of the extras on here so you just have the basics. Empirical presentations, understanding, judgment. The level of intelligence with which we've been concerned so far presupposes and complements a level of presentations that supply the raw materials on which intelligence operates. But the level of intelligence also is presupposed and complemented by a third level, the level of reflection. Every answer to a question for intelligence, what is it? It's this. Raises a further question for reflection, is it so? Revealing that the ulterior motive of conceiving and defining, thinking and considering is to judge. We want to know what is. We don't want to just think. We want to know what is, to judge. We conceive in order to judge. So here, at this level, there emerge the notions of truth and falsity, certitude, and a different meaning of the sense of probability. Talk about
well, this is probably true. You're not talking about a probability in the statistical sense. What you're talking about is that the evidence is mounting more and more, that it certainly looks like this is the case. You're talking about something that is psychological. It's a probability to your judgment, but that's not a statistical probability. That's rather a characteristic of judgment. It's probably the case that so-and-so did this. It's probably the case that the person who robbed me was so-and-so. And the more the evidence comes in, the more probable it looks. You're not talking anything statistical. It's a character of the cognitional process. It's converging upon the grasp of sufficient evidence to make a judgment. The personal commitment that makes one responsible for one's judgment. So let's look at 299 if you've got the book, and if you don't, share it with those of you who do, can share it with those who don't. But 299 is the schematism. He goes from the top down, I'm going from this way up. It will be useful to represent schematically the three levels of cognitional process. First level, data, perceptual images, free images, and interestingly enough, something that I never paid any attention to before until I came up with this thing of Heidegger and Wittgenstein, utterances. Okay, all at this level of empirical presentations. Okay, there's data, perceptual images, free images. The free images are images that human beings have, definitely. We create images. That's what it means by free images. And utterances. So even language has... coming to us at the level of empirical presentations. Okay, that opens up a whole field for investigation there. But anyway, I don't want to emphasize that because he's not emphasizing it. Then at the second level, questions for intelligence. What is this? Okay, what does this mean? Even what does this utterance mean? Okay. Questions for intelligence leading to insights. And then from understanding insights, formulations, but my own formulations. Okay, so not the utterances that came to me from somebody else, but my own formulation. And then questions for reflection, giving rise to reflection, and then in reflection, grasp of evidence, and then judgment. So that's the schema. Okay. The second level presupposes and complements the first. Third level presupposes and complements the second. The second, the exception lies in free images and utterances, both of which are more or less under the control or the influence of the higher levels before they provide a basis for inquiry and reflection. Further, by questions for intelligence and reflection are not meant utterances or even conceptual formulations, but rather the attitude. The inquiring mind. So it's the question is, you don't even have to formulate it, but you've got this desire to know. That effects the transition from the first level to the second, and again the attitude of the critical mind that effects the transition from the second level to the third. Finally, the scheme is anticipatory in as much as the nature of reflection that gives rise to judgment will only be discussed in the next chapter. So that's where there's a new filling out of the cognitive structure here. Yes?
This point that he's making here, that free images and utterances are under the influence of the higher levels.
Right.
Is that because we usually experience, notice things that we want to notice?
No, I don't think, that would be part of what he's getting at, but that...
pre-consciously, that is, not necessarily.
No, I think that's part of it, but I think it's more than that, too, that you can, if you're exploring, let's take utterances first, because I think it's easier there. You're hearing me right now, and those utterances are coming to you at this level, mm-hmm. but... you're not just it's not just an auditory presentation.
Okay. So your reception of the words that I'm speaking is under the influence of the fact that you're understanding. You're getting some meaning out of what I'm saying. If I were talking Japanese, you would probably just be auditory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But because I'm talking a language that you can comprehend, there's meaning there as well. And so you're receiving at an empirical level the sounds that I'm making is also invested by your intelligence. So that's the kind of thing that he's at. And also when I create images, so not perceptual images, which simply would be repeating something that I've seen or heard, but creating an image to help me with moving on. I can create an image. I can create an image that will put the data into a perspective that will make it easier to understand. Well, that's under the influence of my intelligence creating an image. That's the point that he's making. I think that this whole thing about utterances, I mean, I only noticed it this time through after my attempts with a paper that I delivered last summer where I tried to say that Verstehen, Heidegger's Verstehen is operative at this empirical level. This is what he's talking about here. This is what Larmin's getting at. There's an empirical reception that is under the influence of understanding. But it's an empirical reception. And I never even paid any attention to the fact that he's got to be in the book already. I mean, those of us who have been reading Larmin for years tend to think of this level as being only sensation. But it isn't. It's more, I mean, and what he's talking about these as being that on higher levels influencing what we receive at the presentational level. He's talking about the kind of thing that I think we need to develop if the Lonergan community is going to develop dialogue with a lot of contemporary philosophy. But anyway, that's where we are. Yes, sure.
Then is it conceivable that the artistic presentation, for instance, listening to an instrumental music, the understanding happens in this first level?
Yeah, it's under your, I mean, I think when you are, you're, I mean, why does listening to a piece of music mean something to you that it doesn't mean to an adult? You know, that's because your listening is under some other capacity, so it's invested by other capacities.
So it's somehow in between the two.
Yeah. And you're finding something and you're finding some kind of pattern or whatever, you know, but the work of art itself is an objectification of a purely experiential pattern, and you're repeating somehow that by participating in the creation. And to a certain extent, you can teach some animals to do that. You can teach dogs to dance to music and so on, some dogs. It's a whole different thing from human beings participating in the creative pattern. Okay? So, number six. The three levels of cognitional process operate in two modes. This is another thing. This may be a short chapter, but it's filled with important things. So, let's just let me get rid of the three levels operate in two modes, on the data of sense and on the data of consciousness. So the data here can be data of sense, and they can also be data of consciousness. So data include data of sense and data of consciousness. Data of sense include colors, shapes, sounds, odors, tastes, the hard and soft, rough and smooth, hot and cold, wet and dry, and so forth. The direct mode of cognitional process begins from data of sense, advances through insights and formulations to reach reflection and judgment. Thus, empirical science pertains to the direct mode of cognitional process. On the other hand, the data of consciousness consider acts of seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, perceiving, imagining, inquiring, understanding, formulating, reflecting, judging, and you can go on to
deliberating, evaluating, deciding, loving, hating, and so on. Those are all data of consciousness. As data, such acts are experienced. As experienced, just as experienced, they're not yet described, distinguished, compared, related, defined. For that entails understanding. To describe them, to distinguish them, to compare them, to relate them, to define them, is to understand those acts, all of those acts. Finally, these formulations of themselves are just hypotheses. They may be accurate or inaccurate, correct or mistaken, and to pronounce upon them is the work of reflection and judgment. So, I can experience the data of sense, I can have insights into the data of sense, I can judge that my insights into the data of sense are correct. I can experience experiencing, understanding, and judging. I can understand the relations of experience, understanding, and judging to one another. I can judge that I have understood the relations of experiencing, understanding, and judgment to one another. I can bring these operations to bear upon these operations. And in the language of method and theology, I can bring the operations of intentional consciousness as intentional to bear upon the operations of intentional consciousness as conscious. So as conscious, there's an experience of experiencing, understanding, and judging. But there's an understanding also of how experiencing, understanding, and judging are related to one another, and I can judge that I have understood correctly the relations of experiencing, understanding, and judging to one another. So I can experience and understand and judge experiencing, understanding, and judging. So that's the same threefold process applied to data of sense and data of consciousness, applied to data of sense and data of interiority. And the data of consciousness are, of course, far more than simply the cognitional operations. The data of consciousness include our feelings, our emotions, our dreams, and so on. So this is just the beginning. This is only the beginning of this opening up of the realm of interiority as a distinct realm of, eventually a distinct realm of being. We're not talking about being yet. But it's a distinct realm. The knowing of this. Okay. So the three modes of the direct mode of cognitional process provide the data for the introspective mode. So the fact that I experience, understand, and judge the data of sense, that provides me with the data because I experience those acts of experiencing, understanding, and judging. And then I can turn in reflection, I can turn upon those and understand those operations themselves and their relations to one another. And as the direct mode, so also the introspective unfolds on three levels. So the initial level of data, the second level of understanding and formulation, the third level of reflection and judgment. Thus, just to repeat what I just said, one can experience one's experiencing, understanding, and judging. And we all know what from experience the difference. We know what it is to be, to have experience and not understand, or to have experience and understanding, but you're not sure whether you got it right yet. And then to know that you got it right, that says that we know what the difference is among all those. So we can experience one's experience, understanding, and judging, understand the relations that obtain among one's experiencing, understanding, and judging, and judge that one has correctly understood the relations that obtain among one's experiencing, understanding, and judging. And that's what he's trying to do with you and with us in this first part of the book, is to get us to the point where we can judge that we have correctly understood the relations among those three levels of consciousness. In the language of intentionality analysis, one can bring the operations as intentional to bear upon the operations of consciousness. Okay, well, I want to make sure, because if we're missing this, we can't go on. We got this. We've got the three levels, and the three levels can be applied to two different sets of data of sense and the data of consciousness themselves. And of course, what he's doing in this book is he's taking this and applying it to this. He's taking the three and applying it to the three. So he's asking you to experience your own experiencing, understanding, and judging. He's asking you to understand that experience and understanding and judging are related. And he's asking you to affirm, I am a knower, where knowing means I go through this process of experience and understanding and judging. And that's what he's leading up to, the judgment of self-affirmation and judgment. Okay. If you don't have, at least, not that you have to assent yet to what he's doing, but at least you grasp the immigrant intelligibility. All right, number seven. Oh, it's four. Oops, Alright, we will pick up from number 7 on page 2. Boy,